Hello, this is the podcast for our class on August 25. It's basically class number two, and we started off by continuing the topic of vicarious liability. Remember, vicarious liability is just a little island of strict liability in the negligence context. And we talked last class about respondeat superior being responsible for the torts of your employees. Now we have a situation where, in Roessler v. Novak, where a hospital is employing basic medical personnel as independent contractors. And we talked about in class, there's really a lot of good reasons to have independent contractors, but it seemed perfectly apparent that in order to avoid liability, this hospital and many, many others have been using this type of employment scheme. So the question here is, can our injured party sue the hospital under respondeat superior, vicarious liability, even though they weren't officially employees, under the theory of agency? Again, agency is just a contract term that we use occasionally in torts. If someone holds themselves out to be an employee, to represent someone else, they can be considered an agent. And if someone is an agent, they can their torts will have to be assumed by the principal. So the court here talks about apparent agency versus express agency. Someone comes up and says, I'm acting on behalf of New York Law School. That's one thing. That's an express agency. But apparent agency is just acting, is just appearing to do so without, in so many words. So, as we read, the contract agency was always, did the principal hold out the agent, hold out the person as their agent? The court said, well, it also works if the independent contractor did. And here there are enough facts so that a jury could actually decide one way or the other that the independent contractor held themselves out to be the agent of the hospital. And so it's a factual examination. I pointed out that the restatement of torts actually takes a different view and says, would a reasonable person have thought they were an agent? So it's a bit of a twist, but does indicate more of the torts looking at the victim's point of view than, or the injured party's point of view. Then we did the little hypothetical about the security guard and the banana peel, just to illustrate that facts are what are important here. What are the facts that might indicate to either an injured party or under the contract version that the independent contractor might hold themselves out, look that they're holding themselves out as New York Law School's agent? Again, it's a factual examination. Then we talked about the changeover from strict liability into a fault system or negligence system, and Brown v. Kendall was really the seminal case for this, even though it's just a low down the totem pole dogfight, get hit with a stick case. It was used by the judge to make very, very fundamental changes. Up until that time, if it was a direct injury, it was going to be trespass, and it was going to be decided under strict liability. After Brown v. Kendall, which was, you know, Judge Shaw waited for the appropriate case. After Brown v. Kendall, it stood the law on its head, basically, developed the fault system and put the burden of proof on the plaintiff, the moving party, to show that the defendant did not act with reasonable care. Up until now, reasonable care didn't enter into it. It was up to the defendant to show that they acted with extraordinary care. Now it got turned around. What was the reason behind this? Well, you know, as I said before, and most people think, the fault system leads to less liability. And at that point, strict liability being the rule was seen as a hindrance to advancement and industrialization. So the fault system, negligence, there will always be less liability under a negligent system than strict liability. We then talked about five elements for a cause of action for negligence. And we'll go over and over and over this: duty, breach, causation, proximate cause, and damages. Duty and breach in and of themselves mean that you're negligent. But in order to have a cause of action for negligence, a good case for it, you have to have the other elements. So we started right in talking about breach. Duty, we're going to spend a lot of time on whether somebody owes another party a duty of care. But before we get into that, we'd like to talk about and decide, what is this duty of care? Because this is what makes torts, makes negligence very, very unique. Our duty of care is reasonable care, not extraordinary care, not the utmost care, not the highest degree of care, just reasonable care. How we define that is a question of fact. The reasonable, prudent person is our standard. And facts define it. And facts our system thinks that juries are just as good as deciding facts as anybody else. So breach is a question for the jury to decide, and it's very fact-based. We talked about our Adams v. Bullock case. Judge Cardozo kind of hijacked that case, we have to admit. And even though there were two lower court opinions that had said that the trolley company breached their duty of care, did not behave reasonably, Judge Cardozo recharacterized it and said, well, they didn't do everything they could have done. That would have been unreasonable. The things they couldn't have, you know, they could have buried the lines, but it would have cost too much. Insulating the wires to protect them from somebody getting shocked. Well, you know, these wires weren't the same as electrical wires. That wouldn't have worked. He said hiring more guards, that wouldn't have worked. He didn't really say why. So Cardozo decided that in a could-have, should-have world, maybe there were things that they could have done, but it wasn't unreasonable not to have done them. So he used facts to show what they did do, which wasn't a whole lot, I have to say, and talked about that they didn't violate any custom. Things that were suggested were just too expensive. And therefore, they had not breached their duty of reasonable care. They had not created unreasonable risks. Risks were there, we know that, but they hadn't been unreasonable. So next class, we're going to talk about how you define reasonable. Cardozo sort of he used a lot of terms. You only have to use ordinary prevision. You don't have to have extraordinary foresight. You just have to behave prudently. So all of those things are good, but they're very difficult for people and juries to actually apply. So we're going to look at some ways the courts have developed over the years to attempt to put more of a concrete definition on the term reasonable care. So for that, on Monday, we'll start with a very, very famous case of U.S. v. Carroll Towing, where Judge Learned Hand elaborates on the famous hand principle.